listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it is Friday, so it is time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls at our National Town Hall meeting. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. So what's on your plate right now?
Well, there's a lot that's going on. I want to take a moment to kind of focus on a recent poll that came out by the American Values Survey Group. And what they did is they asked the American people questions about the economy. And to nobody's surprise, it turns out that the vast majority of the American people have major concerns about where we are today and, in fact, where we should be going. And the point that this reemphasizes, something that you and I have talked about a whole lot, is that the views that we hold are what the majority of the American people believe. And the problem we have politically is that our right-wing friends have been very, very successful time and time again deflecting attention away from the major economic issues facing this country's issues in which the American people are quite united about how they want to go forward. For example, 66, in terms of this poll, 66% of Americans agree that the government should do more to reduce the gap between the rich and the poor. Two-thirds of the American people. That includes moderates, that includes conservatives, who understand that income and wealth inequality is an enormously important issue in this country, has to be addressed. Two-thirds, I'm not talking about 51%, two-thirds of the American people think we should go forward and address that issue. 57% of Americans favor increasing the tax rate on Americans earning more than $250,000 per year, while 37% are opposed. Again, strong support based on the understanding that the wealthiest people in this country are doing very, very well, and that they are not paying their fair share of taxes. Now, if you listen to the Republicans and some Democrats, it would be hard to imagine that 57% of the American people believe in progressive taxation. Here's another one. We got a Republican Party in Washington where there is virtually no support for raising the minimum wage above the starvation level it is in right now at $7.25 an hour. And here's what the poll says. 69% of Americans favor increasing the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. 69%.
Wow.
That's just not Democrats. That's just not independents. Those are Republicans as well. Listen to this. 78% of Americans favor requiring companies to provide all full-time employees with paid leave for the birth or adoption of a child. 81% of Americans favor requiring companies to provide all full-time employees with paid sick days if they or an immediate family member gets sick. 64% of Americans believe the economic system in this country unfairly favors the wealthy. 64% of Americans believe that the government is not run for the benefit of all of the people. So what you have right now, and those are just some of the issues raised in the poll, so you have a situation where ordinary Americans understand that the economy today is not doing well for the middle class or working families, and in fact, the middle class is disappearing. We have almost as many people today living in poverty as ever in the history of America. They understand the wealthy and large corporations are doing phenomenally well, and they want the government to take action. That's what they want. And yet you have a Republican Party which disagrees with every issue that the American people feel strongly about. They're opposed to raising the minimum wage. They're opposed to pay equity. They're opposed to changing trade policies, which allow corporations to shift jobs to China, Vietnam, and Mexico. They are opposed to a significant jobs program, which will rebuild our infrastructure, put our people back to work. So you have this parallel universe where in Washington, where you have a Republican Party and some Democrats, heavily influenced by big money, have one set of ideas, and in the real world, there's a whole different set of ideas. And if you throw in issues like Social Security, where you had the Republican Party and some Democrats wanting to cut Social Security, this poll didn't deal with that issue. But overwhelmingly, people say, are you kidding? You shouldn't cut Social Security. You should increase and expand Social Security benefits. So I think what we have to focus on is not necessarily to believe that the issues being raised by the media or by the Republican Party are the issues that working families or the middle class or the average person is mostly concerned about. And we can't lose sight of that. It's very easy to do that. But the bottom line is the American people want a government that stands up for all of us, that makes sure that our people have health care, have decent paying jobs, have educational opportunities, don't leave college deeply in debt. They want us to live in a society where we have pay equity, where women earn the same amount for doing the same work as men do. They want to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. And that is what the vast majority of the people want. And then on the other side, you have the big money interests who have a very, very different agenda. And their agenda is to give more tax breaks to the very wealthy and to large corporations working overtime trying to do that. Their agenda is to do what they call entitlement reform. And my friends, anytime you hear somebody talking about entitlement reform, that's just code language for cutting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, something that the American people absolutely do not want. The American people are concerned. I was part of a march last weekend of 400,000 people in New York City demanding that the United States and countries and governments all over the world deal with this crisis of global warming, transform our energy system. That is not what the Koch brothers and other big money interests want. So we live in a very, very strange world where the big money interests are living in a set of policies, are pushing a set of policies which is far removed from where the American people are and what they want. And, you know, I hope that people understand that when they feel the need and the belief a government should create millions of jobs because real unemployment is at 12%, you're not alone. That is what the vast majority of the people want. And if you believe that the minimum wage of 7.25 is really a starvation wage, it has to be raised, that is what the American people want. So it's important that we not allow ourselves to get our attention deflected by the corporate media or by Republicans or some Democrats. The issues that you and I talk about every single week, Tom, those are what the vast majority of the American people want. Now, are there other issues where there is a division of opinion? Yeah. On the issue of abortion, the issue of guns, gay rights, all that stuff, there are divisions, no question. But on basic economic issues, if we stand together, if we elect people who are prepared to fight for the middle class and working families of this country, we can bring about some very fundamental changes and improve lives for a whole lot of people.
Yeah, and an important step. Meanwhile, you've got states like Wisconsin that now has succeeded in knocking 300,000 people off the voting rolls because they don't have ID. They're going to have to issue IDs at the rate of 6,000 a day. And Scott Walker just closed 48 of the state's 72 counties, the DMV offices, down to 2 days a week, weekdays only.
Well, look, this is everybody should understand that no matter what any of these guys say, they're concerned about voter fraud and all that stuff. That's crap. What they are concerned about is one thing. They understand, apropos what I've just been talking about, they understand that ideologically the vast majority of the people are against their agenda.
Right.
So what they're trying to do is keep as many people as possible from being even able to vote. And I've said time and time again, that is, you know, you can disagree on an issue, but to go out of your way to keep people from voting is not American, and it's cowardly.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. He'll be taking your calls right after this break. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. And for all the information you hear about on this program and a whole lot.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can also easily find Bernie's very, very active Facebook page over on Facebook, and you can tweet to him as well. And welcome back. Vicki, you ready to take call, Senator?
Yeah.
Okay, Vicki in Marion, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is about the climate change issue. And just in the narrative we're hearing about the government needs to do, the states need to do, the cities need to do, like that. And I have a friend who tried to put up one of those little individual wind spires mm-hmm. in his own farmhouse, and the little local government told him he couldn't do it for some unknown reason, wouldn't give him a permit. And it occurred to me that if the bigger organizations aren't going to do this, maybe we as individuals need to rise up on a grassroots basis and just start doing it, quit contributing to the problems of the environment and global warming and retrofitting our own houses. I don't know if there's a way to help support a more individual movement on this.
Well, Vicki, thank you for your comments. And I think for those of us who understand that climate change is the most significant environmental planetary crisis that we face, the response has got to be at all levels, individual, local, state, and federal. And you're right that in many communities around America, not just Michigan, there is opposition to sustainable energy, and that's an issue that state government and, in fact, the federal government has got to address. In my view, the federal government can play an enormously important role by investing heavily in sustainable energy. We got some legislation passed a few years ago that put over $3 billion into energy efficiency, helping people retrofit and weatherize their homes. There is enormous potential in so many areas for us to cut back on the use of carbon, and we've got to continue working on that at every level.
Jeremy in Cherokee, Alabama, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator, do you support the repeal of marijuana prohibition?
Let me tell you this, Jeremy. When I was mayor of Burlington, and we have a university town here, and I don't believe anybody got arrested for smoking marijuana, and I think you know, what Colorado is doing is interesting. I'm not a great fan of drugs, I got to say that. On the other hand, it would be hard for me to argue with you that marijuana is a worse product than tobacco. So I think let's see what Colorado does and go from there.
Yeah, watch the experiment.
Yep.
We have about 30 seconds to the break, Senator. I'm curious, the survey that you opened the show with,
yeah.
I went over to sanders.senate.gov and I didn't see it.
We'll get it up. I don't think it is up. It's done by a group called the American Values Survey.
Okay.
It was on September 23rd, very, very recent poll.
Okay, I'll have to track that down because that is...
Well, it confirms, you know, what I think you know and most listeners know, that the issues that we raise are not fringe issues. It is a fringe position to talk about more tax breaks for the rich and large corporations. Very few people support that. Stuff that we talk about, which protects the middle class and working families, is exactly where the vast majority of the people in this country are.
We'll be back with Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions in our National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right after this. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions in our National Town Hall meeting. And let's see here. Ron in Redoso, New Mexico?
Yes.
You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders.
Yep.
Hello?
Hi, how are you?
Hi. I have a suggestion that you may or may not find meritorious. I'm just curious about it. And the thing that brings it up is that I see on the news that the Republicans have blocked your efforts to pass a constitutional amendment on Citizens United,
yep.
which I know is a favorite subject of yours.
Yep.
And here is my thought. There is conceivably a way not to end it, but to hamstring it. Citizens United, I'm talking about. And here is my suggestion. What I would like to see happen is I would like to see every Democrat in the House and Senate sign a petition to the Federal Communications Commission, which says, in effect, you know, the public owns these airways. The use of these airways is like driving a car. It is a privilege and not a right. And therefore, the courts cannot intervene with privileges. And so what we want to do is this. What we want to do is we want to say to the Federal Communications Commission, if you are going to publish a political diatribe or some ad in favor of a candidate, before you can do that, before you can use our airways to do that, you must make a full, fair, and complete disclosure of the natural persons, not the phony baloney corporations, but the natural persons who are actually sponsoring that ad.
Okay, so Ron is calling for transparency.
Well, I think that's an excellent idea, Ron. You touched on a few issues, and I am in agreement with you. We did try in the Senate to pass a disclosure provision. Republicans for years have been saying, well, we don't really need campaign finance reform. We don't need any restrictions. Disclosure will do the work. That's what they used to say. Now they don't say that anymore because their friends are pouring huge sums of money into the system and don't want to be disclosed. But the second point that you raise also, Ron, about the public owning the airwaves, about where I thought you were going, which I think we should go, is to say, you know what, rather than waging campaigns on ugly and often dumb and dishonest 30-second ads, maybe we should make time available to all candidates. That's not a radical idea. That exists in other countries around the world. So if you need 20 minutes, you know, you get a certain amount of time, you could use it however you want. But what I worry about very much is the dumbing down of the political process in this country. I worry very much that, you know, 63% of the American people don't even know which parties control the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, and 60% of the American people are not going to probably even vote in this election. And all of that has a lot to do with the fact that we have a political process in this country where we're not talking about the real issues impacting real people. And I think that having the FCC play a role in opening up time for people to seriously explain their issues would go a long way to educate and raise political consciousness in this country.
Senator, may I ask a question?
Sure.
Over at Daily Kos, they're reporting the Koch Brothers Americans for Prosperity Group has just done a massive mailer in North Carolina. And people are calling the state like crazy on this. Apparently went out to mostly Democratic voters. It says, this is from the piece on Daily Kos, among the misinformation in the mailer, it's about how to register to vote. Two different deadlines for mailing registration applications, instructions to return applications to the North Carolina Secretary of State's office with a return envelope addressed to the State Board of Elections, the wrong group, with the wrong zip code, directing people to the Secretary of State for more information on registering, which that office does not provide, giving the wrong phone number to the Secretary of State's office, telling people that their county clerk will inform them of their voting precinct, which county clerks don't do. They note that misinforming voters intentionally is a felony. Is this the kind of thing that Congress would ever look into?
I think so. I mean, certainly state government should as well. Here you have, and this is the first that I heard about that, I haven't seen the document, but what you have is a group, the Koch brothers, that are spending many, many hundreds of millions of dollars and a lot of money in North Carolina. And these guys believe, it's not talked about very much, but David Koch ran for vice president in 1980 on the Libertarian Party. What the platform was about is ending Social Security, ending Medicare, ending Medicaid, doing away with all campaign finance law, giving more tax breaks to the wealthy, abolishing the EPA, basically ending all federal programs that help working families. And in the last number of years, the Koch brothers have become phenomenally wealthier. They are now worth well over $80 billion, and they are spending their money on stuff like this. Lies in order to make it more difficult for people to participate in the political process. It is an outrage, and I think it should be dealt with at every level, including legally.
Thank you. We'll be right back with your calls for Senator Sanders. in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can find Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And plus, he's got a very active Facebook page and a Twitter account. Check it out. Welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, although people in Vermont, I having been one for 10 years, know well that he represents them, too, and does a marvelous job. Senator Bernie Sanders, check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. Senator, you're still with us?
Right here.
Okay. Linda, in Torrance, California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Senator. It's
morning.
A pleasure to speak to you. My question is this. I've been unemployed for over 7 years now, and I'm currently homeless. Right now I'm house sitting, so I have a place to stay, but that will end soon. And I just wanted to know, is there some way that I get so sick and tired of hearing about corporations being called job creators when they're actually not? Can they put together some kind of a process by which the job creators have to finitely prove the number of jobs they have created domestically in order for them to qualify for a tax cut?
Well, Linda, that's an interesting question. And the answer is that some of us have worked on a variant of that idea. For example, there are a number of programs out there. The Export-Import Bank comes to mind as one, which provides significant help to corporations. And what we have asked is, okay, you want help, tell us about the number of jobs, just as you pointed out, jobs that you have created in the United States of America. So what you do have right now is corporations are getting corporate welfare, despite the fact that they have significantly reduced their workforce in the United States as they move to developing countries where they pay people low wages. And my view, and I think it's the point that you are making, is why are we rewarding and supporting those companies who are throwing American workers out on the street and moving abroad? We should be supporting those companies that intend in growing their workforce here in the United States of America. So the answer is yes, those are issues that some of us are working on.
Henry, in St. Paul, Minnesota, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Pleasure to talk to both of you. Following up with that question, this past Tuesday on CNBC, President Bill Clinton spoke against President Obama's executive order limiting future corporate inversions and recommended that we offer incentives to repatriate nearly $2 trillion in faster overseas funds. Where do you stand on Clinton's recommendations?
Well, we have introduced legislation that would end the entire practice of inversion. And we think that corporations should pay full taxes on their profits. And one of the concerns that I have, and I don't have enough background on what Clinton is talking about, is I don't want to see corporations get a significant reduction in their taxes simply by bringing their money back into the United States right now. That's a tax holiday. These guys have moved to the Cayman Islands or Bermuda to avoid paying their fair share of taxes, and we have legislation in that would mandate that they pay their fair share of taxes.
William in Bakersfield, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, sir. I just have a question for you. If you were a senator in California, how would you bring back major manufacturing to the San Fernando Valley?
Well, I'm not all that familiar with the issues facing the San Fernando Valley, but this is what I do know. I know that in the last 15 or so years in the United States, we have lost about 60,000 factories employing millions of workers at decent wages. And I know that not all of those jobs were lost because of trade policy, but a lot of them were. And I also know that I have been one of those members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, to have voted against virtually every major trade agreement because I understood that the function of those trade agreements was to give corporations a green light to shut down in America and move to China or Mexico or Vietnam or other low-wage countries. So I don't know about specifically about the San Fernando Valley, but I do know that it is absolutely imperative if we're going to rebuild the disappearing middle class, if we're going to create decent-paying jobs in America, if we're going to reindustrialize this country, We have got to substantially increase our manufacturing capabilities, and that means dealing in a very significant way with our disastrous trade policies, which have led us to a race to the bottom.
Jordan in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hi, Mr. Sanders. I had a question for you. I have been a millennial, have been participating in 30 years of Reaganomics here, and something I've been using to try to combat some conservative counterparts is, as they talk about the job creators and they talk about the trickle-down effect, something I've been saying in retort to that, and I was wondering if you could give me some more advice on how to more effectively try to use this, is when does the trickle-down hit? I've been waiting 30 years for the trickle to hit. When does it get here?
Okay. You know, I think one of the areas where President Obama has been weak and where the media has been woefully inadequate is reminding us about the economic record of the Bush administration, which was an absolute disaster. And it's not only that under their watch we saw the collapse of Wall Street, which, by the way, was a result of, in my view, deregulation, allowing these companies to do whatever they wanted to do, to become as large as they wanted to merge with anybody they wanted to merge with, something that I strongly opposed. But what we're talking about, Jordan, is fundamental economics. And what our Republican friends tell us is that if only we give more tax breaks to the rich and large corporations, they will invest, they will create jobs, and everybody will be better off. That's what trickle-down is around. Well, that's what we have done. We did that under Bush, we did that under Reagan, and we're still doing it to a large degree. You got one out of four profitable corporations in this country not paying a nickel in taxes. It is a theory that has failed. By definition, it has failed. The alternative theory, which to me makes a lot more sense, is that when you put money into the hands of ordinary people, especially folks who do not have a lot of money, and that means raising the minimum wage, which would result, if we went to 10-10 an hour, a pay raise to some 25 million Americans. If we push forward a strong jobs program, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure and creating many, many millions of jobs, if you extended long-term unemployment, if you do those types of things, you're putting money into the hands of people who need that money. And what do those people do? Well, they're going to go out and spend that money in their community. They're going to buy products, they're going to buy services, and when they do that, they create jobs in their community. I think that that is the way you create jobs, and I think giving more tax breaks to the rich and large corporations is exactly the wrong thing to do. What that ends up doing is continuing the trend of the kinds of massive income and wealth inequality that we have in America. It does not help working families.
Jesse in Miami, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom, Bernie. Bernie, we have a polarization problem. Do you think that polarization is based more on left and right, putting a basic question to a capitalist? Do you believe all people are created equal?
Well, Jesse, I surely do believe that all people are created equal and are entitled to certain inherent rights. It's what America is supposed to be about. And I think when we talk about the fact that all people are created equal, what it means is that we need a set of policies that protect the interests of so many of our people today who are really struggling economically. We have large numbers of kids in America today who are homeless, who are hungry, all at the same time as 95% of all new income generated since the Wall Street crash has gone to the top 1%. So I believe that we have got to create a nation and a world in which all people have at least a minimal standard of living, all people have health care, all people have educational opportunities, that we create an economy where people have decent paying jobs, are not struggling with terrible minimum wage jobs. But to do that, we've got a big fight to succeed in that. We've got a big fight in front of us. because the billionaire class, the Koch brothers and these other guys, they want it all. In recent years, the Koch brothers have seen a huge increase in their wealth. In fact, since Obama became president, if you can believe it, their wealth has increased almost $1 billion every single month. Every single month. But for these guys, that apparently is not enough. They need more and more and more. And they are using their money, as Tom just mentioned a moment ago, in North Carolina, lying about electoral laws there, putting ugly ads on all over the country. So, Jesse, to, I think, fulfill the American dream, and that dream is that all of our people have good opportunity for a good life, you know, we've got a lot of work in front of us.
Andrew in Lake of the Hills, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Oh, we got 10 seconds. Andrew, let me put you on hold, and we will come back to your question. I'm sorry, I missed that time cue there. The story that the Senator Sanders was referring to that I brought up is over at dailycos.com right now. And we're hitting our music any second, right? Yeah, 5 seconds. So we'll be back with more of Senator Sanders. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter. There's a ton of great information over there. They curate the news. I mean, it's a great news site. Just as a, you know, regularly visit. Plus, you can participate on his Facebook page and then with his Twitter account, all kinds of cool stuff. So be sure to check it out, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can subscribe to the Bernie Buzz over at sanders.senate.gov. Okay, let's see here. Wally in Edwards, Missouri, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller, and I would like to know if Senator Sanders has thought about running for president and having Hillary his vice president, because I think they'd win hands down.
Well, thanks very much, Wally. And the answer is I have given some thought to that. And actually, tomorrow I'll be in New Hampshire, and a couple of weeks we'll be back in Iowa. And it's a very difficult decision, but I am giving thought to it. And it's a difficult decision because the agenda that I would bring forth would require just millions of people to be actively involved in the political process, prepared to take on the billionaire class and corporate America and try to create a nation in which, you know, government works for all of us and not just for the people on top. So not an easy task. But that is, I'm thinking about it and going around the country a little bit, trying to determine what kind of support there is for that agenda.
Lee in Winooski, Vermont, you're on the air. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. This is about the Middle East situation. Most folks who have followed the Middle East for any length of time know that until we get the Shia majority Iran and the Sunni majority Saudi Arabia to work out their differences, that the world will probably be forced to be in this endless cycle of war. But how can America be a legitimate player when we are not really even allowed to discuss anything with Iran on a presidential level?
Well, Lee, good question. Lee is probably 3 miles away from where I am right now. I voted against the resolution that I believe will get the American people more deeply involved. What I worry about is kind of a perpetual war in the Middle East. And I think Lee's point is an exactly right point. ISIS is a disgusting, murderous organization that has got to be opposed. But I think we play into their hands if it appears that it is the United States of America versus ISIS, if it is the West versus the East, if it is Christianity versus Islam, that works to their advantage. What needs to happen, and I think Lee is suggesting this, is you need a coalition of the Muslim countries, and that means the Sunni nations and the Shia nations, to be saying, you know what ISIS stands for is not Islam, and their murderous activity is not acceptable, and we're going to stand up against them. It turns out that Saudi Arabia spends the fourth largest amount of money on military than any other country on earth. They spend more, people are surprised at this, they spend more than the UK does, more than France does. They have a very significant and sophisticated fleet of fighter jets. They have an army. And these are the guys who are going to have to lead the effort. I think the United States should be supportive, but it can't be an American war.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for the Senator right after this. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Merlene in Morriston, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks, Tom and Senator Sanders. I'm one of you. I was wondering if some way or another, this is regarding the voter's ID, if the president couldn't issue an executive order authorizing the U.S. passport offices to issue ID cards to the voters. It's, you know, we have so many people who can't get cards.
Right. Marlene, that is an interesting idea. I think the first goal has got to be is to tear down these anti-voter laws that exist in an increasing number of states. And I would hope that at the state level that will happen. But I think at the federal level, we have got to be as aggressive as we can. You know, when you talk about a democratic society, the most important issue you're talking about is the right to participate in the political process without being impeded. And there is no question that states all over this country are trying to make it harder for low-income people, for older people, for students to vote. And the reason is clear. They understand that the more people learn about their agenda, they don't want it, and they want to vote against it. And these people are trying to keep people from the polling booth. So I think, Marlene, your idea is an interesting idea. That the federal government, where necessary, might be providing the voter IDs that people need.
Andrew in Lake of the Hills, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, Mr. Hartman, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for you about the election process and the money that goes into it. I know you've spoke before about this, but I'm concerned that the way our process works right now and the issues you all talk about will never be addressed because the election cycle changes. People come back into office and they're elected back into office by big business, special interest, and that is what drives our policy. And I just don't see it changing ever. Even I was happy to hear that the other caller asked you if you're going to consider running for president. I hope you do. But I would think that you're going to be under the same issues that some people under the election process are, facing those same things.
Well, Andrew, thank you for raising, you know, for discussing, you know, what I happen to believe is the most important issue when we talk about domestic issues. Because you can't talk about the environment, you can't talk about healthcare, you can't talk about jobs, infrastructure, the economy, education, you can't talk about those issues without talking about campaign finance. And let us be very clear. As a result of these disastrous Supreme Court decisions, Citizens United, McCutcheon, what we have now is the ability of billionaires to spend as much money as they want on the political process, which means they are literally buying elections. And I do not believe that that is what American democracy is about. And so long as you have billionaires buying elections, the people who get money from them or get their support are going to be beholden to them. Earlier in the program, I talked about a poll which shows that the American people are pretty unified in understanding that the government has got to be active in protecting the interest of working families, jobs, raising the minimum wage, education, and so forth and so on. That's what the American people want. They want the wealthy to pay their fair share of taxes, not lower taxes. They want Social Security to be expanded, not cut. But so long as you have people who, for all intent and purposes, are on the payroll of the Koch brothers, That is the agenda that they are going to be pushing. Cuts in Social Security, cuts in Medicare, cuts in Medicaid, cuts in education, more tax breaks for the rich, more money into the military. So I think Andrew is exactly right. Unless we get a handle, and I'll tell you something, you know, people ask me, am I going to run for president or whatever? The stumbling block is I am not sure at this point whether any candidate who stands up for the middle class and working families can beat the billionaire class because of their enormous power. That is the sad reality. Now, we're not going to give up. We have to continue that fight. We got to win this election that's coming up. But let's be very real, as Andrew says. These guys have unbelievable power with all of their money, and that is the major issue that we have got to be focusing on.
Frank in Springfield, Ohio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, Senator Sanders, this is Frank, and God bless you. I hope you run. I'd be one of your biggest supporters. And I am unique, and these are people that chicken hawks don't have the situation I have. I have five kids, four boys and one daughter-in-law, served in the service at the same time. Two was in the Persian Gulf at the same time. They're all out now. Then I got three granddaughters, one in the Air Force and two in the Army, that are serving now.
Frank, pardon me. We're almost out of time here. Can you quickly ask the senator a question?
These chicken hawks want us to go to war, but when it comes to them, Senator, why doesn't anybody challenge them to say, bring back the draft or let their kids go?
All right, Frank. Very good question. Very good question. I'm not in favor of the draft, but I think the point that you are making is that when you have a volunteer army, it is not the children of the wealthy or corporate America who are going to be fighting in Syria or Iraq. It is basically working families, the kids of working families who come from working families. And it's very easy to send those kids off to war if it's not your own kid. So I'm not a fan of the draft, but I do think we need a foreign policy which understands that just because the kids in the military do not come from wealthy families, that we're going to protect those kids as well and not get them into wars that we should not be fighting.
Senator, 30 seconds to the end of the hour. Final thoughts?
What I want to say is that these are tough times in our country. They're tough times economically and they're tough times politically. But the stakes are much, much too high in terms of issues like war and peace, the creation of jobs, the opportunity for kids to get an education. We cannot get discouraged and not participate. In fact, we have to double our political efforts, because if we see Republicans controlling the Senate, do you think things are bad right now? They're going to get a heck of a lot worse.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much for dropping by.
My pleasure. Take care.
Always an honor. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Programs.
Stick around.
Oh, and in a third hour today, Lamar Waldron's going to drop by. A lot of fascinating stuff there.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And yesterday on this program, a number of people called in and said, you got to watch this show about the Roosevelts that Ken Burns put together, Ken Burns, It's over on PBS, and you can also buy the DVD and watch it and all that kind of stuff. So last night, I watched part of, it's like, the first segment, there's like, seven of them, I think, and the first one runs almost 2 hours, and so I didn't get through the whole thing. I got partway into it and then was falling asleep, so I went to bed. But the thing that shocked me was that this supposedly nonpartisan thing starts out with George Will. And, as partisan or as a Republican as you can get, trashing basically the Roosevelts for not respecting the Constitution. And in fact, that's preceded George Will's little riff. And this is, this is the essence of the entire Republican Koch brothers argument, is that if the Constitution doesn't say that the government may help pay for public schools, then the government can't. It's not an enumerated power. That if the Constitution doesn't say that the government may provide Social Security to people and be a, provide, as it were, poverty insurance for old age, then you can't do it because it's not an enumerated power. If the Constitution doesn't say that the government can provide Medicare and Medicaid, you can't do it. It's not an enumerated power. And on and on and on. The Constitution doesn't say that I was going to say the interstate highway system. One of the enumerated powers in the list in Article 1, Section 8 is the power to build roads for the post office, postal roads. So I suppose you could stretch that. And the fact of the matter is that various of the founders at various times used this enumerated powers argument to go against the things they didn't like, and they conveniently ignored it when we were talking about things that they did like. For example, Thomas Jefferson, he used the enumerated powers argument against the federal government supporting a private bank, the first bank of the United States, which was a bank while he was president. He didn't try to take it down while he was president, but before he was president in 1791, when Congress was debating it, or when it was being debated, during the George Washington administration, he wrote a long piece saying, Congress doesn't provide us with the authority to take federal money, tax dollars, and create a private for-profit corporation for the purposes of stabilizing our banking. This is something that should be done by the Treasury Department. Now, I frankly agree with him on that, at least in principle. I think that, the Fed should be taken under the Treasury Department. And this is an argument that Jefferson was making in 1791. He also made it in 1817. But broadly speaking, the one of the enumerated powers in the Constitution, and I'll read it to you. One of among the powers given to Congress, right? Article 1, Section 8. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duty imposed and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. So basically, and Jefferson makes this argument that if you can claim that this is actually for the general welfare of the United States, if you can prove that, then you've got a case. And that's the provision under which people like FDR said Social Security is legal. Medicare is legal, LBJ said. Medicaid is legal, LBJ said. Is constitutional. But anyhow, this is how the Roosevelts start, with this essential rewriting of early American history and expounding the Antonin Scalia, David and Charles Koch view of the Constitution, which shocked me. I mean, I'm sitting here watching this thinking I'm going to see a piece of history, and the framing device, this is literally the first sentence, the first on-air interview, the first sentences of the Roosevelts, this PBS documentary by Ken Burns. Here it is.
Jefferson's view of government was that government can only do that which is explicitly enumerated in the Constitution of the United States. Theodore Roosevelt, coming one century later, precisely one century later, says, no, government can do anything that is not specifically prohibited in the Constitution. And he believed that the government of the United States had to be much more central, energetic, and assertive than the Constitution had envisioned it, or we could not go on as a nation.
I think both presidents regarded the Constitution as a nuisance. That is something that was all right in the late 18th century, but just didn't fit their country, and more important, them. They had bigger dreams, and they thought that the Constitution was elastic enough to accommodate their ambitions.
Right. So we're going to open the piece about the Roosevelts by trashing the Roosevelts by saying that both Teddy and Franklin did not respect the Constitution, did not view it the same way the founders did, and basically used an illegal, or at least an unconstitutional, perspective on things to move forward with what Teddy Roosevelt called the Square Deal and what Franklin Roosevelt called the New Deal. I was shocked. I mean, I'm looking at this thing going, really? This is your frame? PBS? Your basic frame is that the Roosevelts, oh, yeah, they might have done some great stuff, but it was all illegal. They were stretching and twisting and distorting the Constitution. And so maybe we should just, like, undo it all. I mean, this is the Koch brothers' agenda. This is the Tea Party agenda. This is the Libertarian agenda. This is now increasingly the Republican Party's agenda, is undo every piece of both the New Deal and the Square Deal. Teddy Roosevelt fought for inheritance taxes. They want to undo that. Teddy Roosevelt fought for a maximum number of hours in the workplace. It was 50 hours when he was president. The conservatives want to undo that. Teddy Roosevelt fought for a minimum wage. He didn't get it. Franklin Roosevelt got it. Conservatives want to undo that. Teddy Roosevelt fought for child labor laws. He didn't get them. Franklin got them. The Supreme Court struck them down, and then the Supreme Court reversed itself. So what's constitutional, right? But George Will, this partisan Republican hack, opening this history piece, saying, well, you know, the Roosevelts thought the Constitution was so elastic, they just kind of ignored the damn thing. You know, so, really? So to those of you who thought it was a wonderful documentary and learned a lot from it, and I'm sure that the rest of it is, I still have a lot of respect for Ken Burns as a documentary maker. I just don't know how he let that slip through. How do you start a documentary about basically a political family that had tremendous impact on the United States? And it wasn't, I mean, the Franklin Roosevelt branch of the family and the Teddy Roosevelt branch of the family basically didn't communicate with each other. They were very separate. You know, these guys didn't know each other, for example. So it's not like the Kennedys or the Bushes where you've got, you know, you can identify Joe Kennedy or George Herbert Walker Bush as kind of the patriarch, and then they pushed their progeny along, or John Adams and John Quincy Adams. But, you know, it's a nice little frame to stick it all into. Two branches of the same family who don't believe in the Constitution. Now let's see what they did. I was just astonished. Just astonished. So, anyway. End of rant. Now, as I said, you can find Thomas Jefferson talking about enumerated powers, specifically with regard to a private bank being the bank for the United States. And frankly, I think he may have made a very, very good case. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But that doesn't mean that he opposed any government action for the general welfare, which is the rest of what Teddy and Franklin were doing. Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here. Forgive my opening rant there, but I just couldn't resist. Tom in Tucson. Hey, Tom. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Tom, is it possible, or how possible would it be for the Congress to pass a bill, which I know Obama would sign, levying a special internet tax on those of us who have an internet connection, and that special internet tax used to fund the connection of the internet in every schoolhouse, in every state in the United States and its territories.
Hmm. You know, a much easier way to do that, Tom, would be to do what Chattanooga, Tennessee has done and a couple of other communities, where the community itself sets up, it sets themselves up as the internet service provider. They put the internet in everybody's home, high-speed internet, low cost. And then in the schools, since they're the internet service provider, they decide who pays what. They put it into the schools for free. So, you know, if we had publicly owned internet services, that would be a no-brainer.
Tom?
Yeah.
Just one last question.
Mm-hmm.
If Walmart increased its wages for everyone by 50%, would I have to pay more money when I shop for food there?
No, in all probability. The Walton family, the five heirs to the Walmart fortune, the principal recipients of the distributed profits of the Walmart Corporation, the dividends, that family is worth more money than the bottom 40% of Americans. So, you know, they might see their wealth increase at a slightly slower rate. But frankly, I doubt even that would happen. You know, labor is such a small percentage of the cost of doing business for Walmart, you know, raising their wages. In fact, if you look at Costco, which competes with Sam's Club, Costco, you know, starts people out at $30,000, $40,000 a year. And it starts them around 30, 25 to 30, and they can make 40 if they've been there for a while. And, you know, they keep their people. Walmart would have lower turnover, fewer people coming and going, which would actually help their profits. So, you know, it's pretty straightforward, Tom. Thanks for the call. Leonard in Ridgelwood, North Carolina. Hey, Leonard, we've got a minute to the break. What's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Leonard? No, Leonard. Okay, here's the deal. When you get put on hold, you've got to listen to your phone. Turn down your radio, turn down your TV, because there's a delay built into both. There's a delay. We have an obscenity delay on this end, so we can, you know, just drop 10 seconds of audio. But also on TV, there's an additional delay just as a result of all the hardware in between us. We send the signal from here to Denver. Denver processes it, sends it up to the satellite. The satellite then processes it and sends it to your home. And, you know, in theory, all that happens at the speed of light. But in actual practice, there's about a 10-second delay. So you got to listen to your phone. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Friday, D.C. and Durham, North Carolina. You wanted to comment on the Roosevelt documentary?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, actually, I agreed with your comments on the Roosevelt shows. I like Ken Burns as well, and I've seen most of two or three of the episodes, and what I was hoping that you would do is agree to watch the rest of them and then give us your opinion about it, because I definitely respect your view of history.
Thank you. You know, I fully intend to. It's just a matter of time.
Yes, I imagine you've got plenty to read and plenty to write. And yeah. So if you ever get a chance, though, I have found that except for wanting to take my shoe off and throw it at the TV whenever George Will is on, I for the rest of it, I really found a lot to learn and a lot of interesting parallels between the progressive era and right now, what we're going through. And, you know, what Teddy Roosevelt was dealing with, trust busting, was something that we could use a whole bunch of right now.
Oh, yeah.
And it appears that we are lacking that charismatic progressive figure like either of the Roosevelts would qualify as, I think, compared to what we have now. And I think that really comes out in some of the later episodes, that, you know, these guys were pretty amazing guys in a lot of ways. Although, aside of Teddy Roosevelt, I had not fully understood was his really his penchant for aggression on other nations was, you know, something I learned about.
Oh, yeah. Started with the Spanish-American War.
Yeah, and even World War One, and he kind of liked war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, he was a tough guy. He liked killing animals too. I mean, he was all about that stuff. That's what manly men did back then.
But, yeah, he was kind of a man's man, and yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to thank you for what you do and encourage you to watch those other episodes, if not just to be able to kind of reflect back to us what your thoughts are on it. It is pretty fun to watch them.
I will do that. I just, yesterday I committed to watch them, and last night I started, and the first thing that I got hit in the face with was, you know, well, these guys were unconstitutional, but we're going to do a documentary on them anyway. It was like, really? Really? DC, thanks for the call. Thanks for the heads up. And thanks for watching us on Roku. Ash in Lawrence, Kansas. Hey, Ash, what's up?
Hi. Well, you know, Ken Burns can't make a documentary about baseball without talking to George Will for an hour. But
really? Is George Will in all of Ken Burns' documentaries?
Well, I don't know if he's in all of them. I've only seen baseball because I'm a baseball fan.
Uh-huh.
He is in that just every single, well, they called them innings. He was in every one of them.
Agree. That's
amazing.
But
I actually
wanted
to talk about Colorado Amendment 64. It's, you know, they passed that, and it's in the thing that, you know, it's in the amendment that cannabis is meant to be taxed and regulated in a manner similar to alcohol, and they're not supposed to put any prohibitive regulations on doing that. And yet, you know, when I think about alcohol, the first thing I think about is, you know, the dozen or so bars within a 5-minute walk of my house.
Right.
And they've basically banned any kind of public house for cannabis. And so, actually, I've been working with a group of Coloradans to try to create a movie theater with a private cannabis lounge, and
right,
and
do it
from there, lobby to.
Well, here's the problem, Ash, and it's the same problem that cigar smokers have, is that you know, I mean, even heroin addicts are more discreet in the distribution of their drug into their nearby environment than are people who smoke, whether it's tobacco or whether it's pot. The fact of the matter is, when you're smoking something, it gets into the air, and anybody nearby is inhaling that. So, you know, a cannabis club, much like a cigar club, where everybody is agreeing to be equally contaminated by the air, might be an interesting or useful thing. Although some people may end up getting a lot higher than they want. But, you know, on the other hand, I was in a cigar club once years ago with a friend who was smoking, and I was not smoking, and I actually got nauseated as a result of being, you know, just my response to tobacco as an ex-smoker is now almost an allergic response. But, you know, maybe if they were passing out liquid, you know, pot-infused vodka or something, I don't know. What do you think?
Sure, pot, you know, there are lots of other ways other than just cannabis, you know, other than just smoking. But,
yeah.
I mean, they, you know, Colorado does have cigar bars, and they have special, you know, dispensation. And the,
yeah. Maybe you could have vaporizers that are run like hookahs, where you've got 6 or 8 hoses going to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what you exhale is basically just water vapor.
Right, right.
There are lots of, you know, very discreet ways. But, you know, as tourists coming in, you know, you go in and there's literally no place to go, yeah, unless you've researched ahead of time and made sure that your hotel room is smoker friendly.
Right.
And who wants to spend a vacation in their hotel room?
Right, right.
So I feel like, you know, Colorado really needs to do something to open that up.
Well, and I'm guessing that'll come. And there's probably a few hoteliers who are looking around going, huh, pot tourism. I mean, you know, maybe we should, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, Louise and I have been to Amsterdam many, many times. And the hotels used to let you smoke dope in the hotel. In fact, sometimes they sold it in the lobbies, or in the restaurants, rather. But they also let people smoke cigarettes. This was back before the Anon smoking. Basically, since I've been doing this show since around 2002, I've only been back to Europe once, or at least to Amsterdam once. I'm not sure where they're at on it now, but I think there's a lot of commercial potential there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back with your calls. We'll be right back. Tuesday. Tom Hartman here with you. Right wing alert. We need a theme song for this one. We used to have one. It was you know, If I Only Had a Brain, you know, from I can't sing worth a damn. If I Only Had a Brain from Wizard of Oz. For our conservative alerts, conservatives are hysterical that this guy in Oklahoma who worked in a food processing plant, who was fired, who has a long rap sheet and a long history of violence. 5 minutes after he was fired, he went on a rampage with a knife and killed one guy and cut his head off, or nearly did, and went after another guy. And the owner of the plant shot Mr. Nolan. Mr. Nolan is the was the knife wielder, Alton Nolan. And he's now in the hospital. He's expected to survive, and he will be charged with murder and all this kind of stuff. And I'm guessing, apparently, based on some of the calls that Danielle has been getting, that either Fox News or right-wing talk radio or both are trying to suggest that somehow this guy was, like, recruited by ISIS, or this is the, you know, the first Muslim ISIS attack in the United States. Give me a break. You guys need to dial down your level of terror. Stop being such pathetic scaredy cats. You know, I realize you frighten easily. You know, I'm just talking to you, Republicans, conservatives. I realize you frighten easily. Dick Cheney and George Bush realized that, too. They manipulated you very effectively using your fear. They continue to. They use your fear of black people. They use your fear of having your gun taken away, your fear of everything, which you can defend yourself against with a mighty penis, right? A mighty phallic symbol, a gun. They manipulate you on so many levels. Using your fear, using your propensity for fear, your base, you know, you were born fearful, apparently. Maybe you had a horrible childhood, or who knows what it is that makes a person a conservative Republican, but let go of it. It's not worth, you know, sitting up at night worrying that the Muslims are coming to get you because one mentally ill guy popped his cork in Missouri. Or in Oklahoma, rather. It's not worth it. Get over it. This is the land of the brave and the home of the free, not the land of the petrified and the home of the trembling. Maxine in Louisville, Colorado. Hey, Maxine, what's up? Maxine?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
So I want to get back to the comment that Bernie made about ISIS in Syria. And it's funny because what got me thinking about this is actually watching the Roosevelt documentary. And when this country was faced with atrocity in Europe, Hitler, during World War II, there was a huge anti-war movement. There was a lot of talk about that's chaos in Europe. It's over there. It's not coming here. And I know, you know, you have to be very careful about referencing Nazis because everyone gets hysterical. But I'm Jewish, and I think about the millions of Jews that died and the resistance of America to get involved in what was a moral conflict. And I look at some of what's coming out of Iraq and Syria with some serious moral issues in terms of the rampage of beheadings and rapes and stonings and just horrific treatment. Now, I don't think we can quite equate this with that, but at what point, I'm just curious in your response, what you think about this, at what point does America have an obligation to engage when we see that kind of absolute lack of any morality? We see barbarism. We did it, obviously, in the Balkans, and we didn't in Rwanda, and President Clinton said that was one of the things he regretted most about his presidency. So I'm just curious about your perspective on that.
Yeah. I think that the more important question is not, is there something terrible happening in which we should get involved, but rather, is there something terrible happening and our involvement will be more productive than counterproductive? And clearly our involvement in the Balkans was more productive than counterproductive, although there are people on the Serbian side who might argue against that. Had we intervened in Rwanda, arguably, I mean, it happened very, very quickly. Arguably, we might have had some impact. Interestingly enough, by the way, the Rwandan massacre was driven by talk radio. Talk radio hosts in Rwanda were urging people to go out in the streets, were urging, was it the Hutus to go out and murder the Tutsis? I think that's the way it was. It might have been the other way around. But it was driven by talk radio. So the question then, we see this awful ideology that is fueled by this part of the Middle East having the highest unemployment rate among people under 30 of any part of the world. Right, this massively high unemployment rate at the same time that the region is dealing with food crises that have to do with global warming, climate change, that has incredibly raised the price of food in these parts of the world. And we're not dealing with the unemployment issue. I would say probably 80 to 90% of these guys, the people who are involved in ISIS, they're not the hardcore true believers at the center. They're the people who are on for the ride, and ISIS has a lot of cash, and they're paying their soldiers well. And when they take over territory, they restart the schools, they start the public infrastructure going, they try to make people like them. It doesn't always work. People are tired. For example, they had to stop in I think it was in Erbil, they had declared smoking illegal. And then they had to undo that day before yesterday because so many people were smoking and they couldn't, you know, whip them all. But the question is, what can we do that will be effective? And, you know, the president has made a decision, a bet, that airstrikes and bringing together the countries in the region, the regional Sunni powers in particular, although he's apparently coordinating with both Iran and Syria in a non-official way, is the best way to bring about change. And I would say it's probably a reasonable start. I would like Congress to be involved in this. I'm enough of a constitutionalist.
It's interesting that you bring up unemployment and food shortages, because that was also what was going on in Nazi Germany.
You're right.
Between, you know, after World War One, it was the same thing that led people to follow basically a madman.
Well, and here in the United States, in the late 20s and early 30s, when we had these huge food lines and people were, you know, sleeping on the streets because they were homeless, you also saw a significant rise of the Nazi movement in the United States, as well as the Marxist movement. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was threading a very delicate needle between the communists on one side and the fascists on the other side, both of whom were taken seriously and considered legitimate political players, because we hadn't seen how communism played out in the Soviet Union yet, and we hadn't seen how fascism played out in Germany yet. And, you know, we can see all that with hindsight now, but we didn't know at the time in the 30s where these things were going to go. So
I just think these are very interesting questions for progressives. I don't think they're easy, and but I think it's important that we're really thinking about what is going on and not just taking the attitude that, okay, this is happening over there and we shouldn't be involved. And I think, you know, like it or not, America does seem to have a moral obligation in the world. And sometimes we've acted on that obligation in a really positive way, and sometimes we have failed to act. And I think it's not an easy answer, and it drives me crazy when I hear all the pundits on either side trying to simplify it.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you, Maxine. And I think that, you know, what pleases me so much about President Obama versus President Bush is Bush actually had, when he decided that he was going to invade Afghanistan and Iraq, and apparently he had decided to invade Iraq even before he ran for president, but when he was going public with that decision, he had to bring people into the White House to sit him down and explain to him what a Sunni was and what a Shia was. I mean, I'm not making this up. This is how little he knew about the region. Whereas President Obama is learning everything he can. He's taking a very nuanced approach to this thing. He's you know, walking it through carefully. Congress won't play because there's an election coming up, and because they don't want to do anything that might make President Obama look good. This is all about the Reagan legacy project. You know, now it's the Obama anti-legacy project. And, you know, so we just have to acknowledge that. But Maxine, I get what you're saying, and this is one of the reasons why we need to have a debate in the House and in the Senate, so that the public can participate by contacting people's elected representatives and, you know, and exactly, you know, what do we do and how do we do it? But I really think that no matter how many people you kill, as long as you have food shortages and massive unemployment, 30% yeah. unemployment among people under 30 years old, you are always going to have problems. In Los Angeles, it's called the Crips versus the Bloods, if I'm remembering my gangs right, where you have, in those areas where you have high unemployment, the gangs go in and do recruiting. In Syria, where you have high unemployment, ISIS goes in and does recruiting. There's not that big a difference, in my mind, between the vulnerability of these badly unemployed populations to gangs in Los Angeles, to Nazis in Germany in the 1930s,
yeah.
or to ISIS in Syria or Iraq. And as a consequence,
warlords.
Right. We have to deal with the driving factors here. We have to, you know, and I'm hearing no discussion about that right now, which concerns me. That, you know, people need schools, they need infrastructure. Instead, we're blowing up infrastructure. We devastated Iraq. Had Bush not devastated Iraq, I don't think any of this would be going on right now, or at least not much of it. But we really need to be looking at the causes. Maxine, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the cause is not just a bizarre Muslim ideology. There are bizarre Christian ideologies. David Koresh didn't go national. We didn't have this huge problem there. Welcome back. Anita in San Antonio watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Anita. You want to talk about George Will?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure George Will has been in all of Ken Burns' documentaries. I know he was in the Civil War one.
Whoa. Are they cousins?
Then, yeah. I don't know. Maybe they're just good friends. But he was also in the baseball, which was, I think it was called When It Was a Game.
Right.
And then, of course, the Roosevelts. Huh. But I also noticed that I know the Koch brothers give a lot of money to PBS.
Right.
And I just wondered if that had any kind of connection to the type of opening that the Roosevelts got.
Right.
That
so,
documentary.
Yeah, for people who don't know what we're talking about, I mentioned this maybe a half hour ago that I watched the Roosevelts, and it opens with this guy saying, well, Jefferson thought we should only do what the enumerated powers of the Constitution say. And then you get George Will saying, yeah, and Franklin and Teddy both decided that the Constitution was an inconvenience and that it was elastic and they could stretch it however they want. And it was like, you know, yeah, these guys were criminals to the Constitution, but, you know, let's watch a documentary about them anyway. And I was just shocked. So
yeah, that's a little disappointing because I really want to watch it, but I guess I'll just have to miss the beginning
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's, you take the good with the bad. But
right.
I was just... I guess this is the first Ken Burns documentary I've seen in probably a decade and a half. And I didn't know that his proclivity was to put George Will in his movies. So anyhow, thanks for the tip on that, for the heads up, Anita. Ricky in Nashville, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Ricky, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Tom, for lack of knowledge, I guess, I'd like to ask you a question. And it basically is based upon everyone's talking now about this global economy and what we have to do with other countries around the world. But my question to you is, wasn't it George Washington that said, let us honor our obligations to these foreign nations and then let us sever our ties with them? Could you comment on that and tell me if I'm accurate in that statement?
I don't recall that specific quote, but I know in his farewell address, he specifically argued against foreign entanglements, you know, beware of foreign entanglements. I'm not that much of a George Washington scholar, but it wouldn't surprise me. That's absolutely consistent with the worldview that George Washington had, which was a rather, you know, kind of insular and isolationist America. So, yeah, may well have been. Ricky, thanks for the call. Kent in Somerville, South Carolina. Got a minute to the break. Kent, quick one.
Yeah, Professor Tom. There's two things I want to talk about. The Oswald assassination. There was a woman who came forward probably in the late 80s or 90s,
mm-hmm.
and she was a grandmother-looking woman, and she said that she was Oswald's girlfriend.
Right.
When I guess they were separated from his wife.
Right.
And she worked for the doctor who worked for the CIA who was trying to kill Castro. I think he was the one that was coming up with the cigar loaded with some kind of chemical to kill him. And she said that they were very much in love. Now, if he
if he was working with the, if he was girlfriends with a guy trying to kill Castro, I think that he was a CIA agent. All the facts, I mean, him.
Oh, Oswald was a CIA agent. Or officer, I mean, or whatever. He worked for the CIA. He went to Russia as a spy for the CIA. He was brought home by Senator John Tower without even being debriefed by the FBI, a guy who had renounced his passport and you know, pled allegiance to the Soviet Union. And John Tower gets him through customs. No, he definitely is what he said. Kent, thanks for the call. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and it's Nay Day! Time for the author of Sideswiped and a reporter for the Talk Radio News Service, Congressman Bob Nay. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
So what is going on in the world today?
Well, in the world today, there are two major things. There's a lot of things, but domestically, Eric Holder, of course, has announced he will be staying in place until a new appointee has been found, but that, you know, he will not be continuing on. And that leaves, of course, the question of who in the media is trying to seek out people and get a yes or no from them. But the White House itself has not obviously made the move yet. But there's two different theories, Tom, right now, schools of thought from within the Democratic side about making the move to replace him. And the one is to do this while the Senate is firmly under the Democratic control, although if the Democrats control the Senate, which they may, and they lose a few seats, it becomes that much more difficult. That's the one theory.
Right.
The second theory is to not do that. And if it does change hands, or the Republicans make too much of it during a, quote, wartime situation of not going along with an attorney general, will cause them some heartburn. So that's just internally the two schools of thought that are coming out of the Hill more privately than public.
Interesting. Yeah, it's got to be a delicate political calculus. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going through something similar to that right now, where she said to a reporter a couple days ago, if I was to retire from the Supreme Court, the president doesn't have enough political allies in the Senate to get through a replacement of me who is as progressive as I am. And she's probably right, but you know, I'm not sure that that's the best reason not to resign. But she's, you know, it's a tough one, especially with these guys absolutely committed to denying any kind of legacy to this president, any kind of successes whatsoever.
Well, that's true, and you know, some of the things that the neocon or Republican side have criticized Holder for today are, frankly, some of the things that were legacies from the Bush administration. Both the NSA and then the Fast and Furious, which were initiated then, and yes, did go through at the time Eric Holder's been there, but his you know, his legacy of voting rights and civil rights, and he was embarking upon the fact that, you know, we have to look at sentencing guidelines, and started to recant, and he couldn't complete it, but on, as you say, the banksters and what to do about them on criminal charges. So. But I think mostly, you know, voting rights and will be a good legacy. And the other thing, the one thing I point out, the Republicans are saying about, you know, politicization, how political he was, that in itself is absolutely not a case. Anybody that knows Eric Holder knows that he's actually been criticized for not being political enough in many cases.
Yeah. My take on him is fairly simple. It's that he's a good and decent man who, in those areas that didn't cost billionaires or corporations anything, he was fairly aggressive and did a good job, whether it was gay rights, pot rights, African Americans' rights, civil rights, all these areas. He was, you know, he refused to enforce DOMA, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to things that cost billionaires or corporations money, he was, you know, I mean, for example, they had 40 different prosecutions against the banksters that cost the banksters some $80 billion. That's nothing. These banksters made off with at least $5 trillion. That's how much they stole from all of us. And every time one of Holder's prosecutions was successful, the stock in the banks would go up, because what it allowed them to do was get off their books that sort of Damocles of a potential criminal prosecution. I think that he really horribly dropped the ball on those things, and probably because he came out of a silk stocking law firm where they defend the tobacco companies and the banksters and whatnot. It's a big corporate law firm, and that's his background. But who knows?
He started to recant on that at the very end here. Actually, about 3 months ago, made a statement basically saying that, maybe he looked at that, in the wrong way. So we'll see what happens.
Talk is cheap.
I know. And he waited so late to do that. I wanted to mention ISIS because of the fact of that situation, but also here in the, quote, the homeland, because now we're starting to see sort of a deja vu, Tom, of what we saw after 9/11. In the sense that the government says that there was a definite plot on airliners coming to the United States. Now they say, there wasn't a definite situation going to happen. So we're just starting to see a lot of information, misinformation.
Well, a definite plot came out of Iraq, didn't it? And might that have just been, let's hype this this thing and get more American money?
Well, and I think that's the point I was going to make. They have to be, the government and people, I think, very careful as we're reporting on these last week. Oh, this for sure was going to happen because, it's been confirmed, and then we find out it isn't. But, it gets out there, and you can't take it hardly back. So I think a lot of it is, and the Iraqis have, they're not known for their intelligence ability to gather information, but they have everything to gain by having us, fear an attack of some type. So vis-a-vis the subway situation, which the prime minister of Iraq had made a statement, and now the Iraqi government itself is saying, well, no, we don't know of any specific type of deal on that.
Right.
And, of course, meanwhile, the British Parliament has now had a vote, and they're in this this whole movement. The vote was 524-43.
Hmm. That's pretty solid.
Pretty solid vote, but they did wait later on this one because originally, of course, they were right there with George Bush,
right.
Searching for the weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, burned once, right twice away. Shy.
So they got a little bit gun shy on this and at least waited a bit to try to get into it. And we're having trouble getting Turkey into the fray of this, although there's been some.
Well, Turkey is very concerned. I mean, if they do anything to empower the Kurds, they have a big problem with the Kurds and their southern border. A minority that arguably Turkey has been oppressing, and there's a significant Turkish independence movement. I mean, a Kurdish independence movement in southern Turkey.
That's correct.
And they don't want to. Well, it's kind of
you're
a mess.
You're listening up to Tom Hart.
Yeah. So, Bob, what do we have about? Oh, we got to wrap it up. Okay. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com and free-don.org. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Always great talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm pleased to have my old friend and writing partner, Lamar Waldron, in the studio with me today. Hey, Lamar.
Great to be with you again, Tom.
Great to have you join us. You have a new book out. It is, where to go? It's over here. Oh, did you put that there, Jim, so you can get a shot of it? Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay, it's called The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination by Lamar Waldron, and it describes exactly how Godfather Carlos Marcello had John Kennedy killed, along with the help of Santo Trafficante and others.
And plus, it's really a compendium in many ways of unreleased files that different agencies, especially the Secret Service, but all the big federal agencies, the FBI, CIA, have been keeping secret for 50 years at this point.
Wow. Is there a JFK conference in town this weekend? Is that
there
right?
There is, in fact, and if people want to know more, they can go to AARC.org, I believe it is. It's the Assassination Archives and Research Center. You may remember 25 years ago we would come up to Washington and to their old facility with the old hand-operated elevator.
Yep. And what was his name, the guy who was running it?
Well, Jim Lazar.
Yeah.
Is still, he's doing this conference. And this has all of the JFK... Not all, but pretty much the vast majority of the JFK authors and experts and even government investigators at one conference. For the
Tony Summers is going to be here?
Tony Summers is going to be here.
That's great.
G. Robert Blakey, who headed the House Select Committee on Assassinations, who was their chief counsel. And just about every JFK author you can think of is going to be there. You know, but we've really all kind of come together because we all have different conclusions because we've all looked at different information, or, you know, not everyone is as crazy as me to spend 25 years, you know, starting out with your help to investigate not just the Secret Service, but also the CIA and Lyndon Johnson and everybody. But, you know, we're kind of all coming together this weekend so that we can focus on getting these darn JFK files released because it's been over 50 years. In fact, this week is the 50th anniversary of the release of the Warren Report.
Right. So these are the files that you're talking about are the files that Bill Clinton authorized release of, didn't he?
Well, Congress unanimously passed the JFK Act in 1992, and we have to give credit to Oliver Stone because it was the publicity surrounding his JFK film that finally prodded Congress to unanimously, how often does that happen, pass this law, and Ted Kennedy was a big supporter of it as well. He was fine with whatever was going to come out, John Kerry was a big booster of it. And then that was actually passed under Bush, Democratic majority.
In the election year, 92.
Right. But then he waited. He actually rushed out some documents to try to keep Congress from passing that law.
He being Bush?
Bush, who was a former CIA director, who, while he was CIA director, let's just say a lot of files were withheld from congressional investigations in the 70s. So he kind of pushed some documents, old CIA documents, out in an effort to stem the passage of this law. It didn't work. But those documents that got kind of rushed out real quickly, those were a gold mine for you and I.
Yeah.
And then it was left to Bill Clinton to appoint this review board. Many of the agencies, especially the CIA, the Secret Service, and the Office of Naval Intelligence, just stonewalled up a blue streak. They had to actually extend the term of this review board. It was originally supposed to end, I believe, in 97. So many files hadn't been turned over. Extended it to 98. You know, the last day, the last week, suddenly, you know, all these agencies are finding files that they should have been the first files given. Right. You know, tape recordings of Carlos Marcello, the Godfather, talking about aspects of the assassination.
This is when the FBI was bugging his, through Jack Van Lanningham.
Right,
his
in the mid-80s. Yeah. You know, they sat on that until the very end. You know, the CIA, all of their plans, the plans for a coup in Cuba and the AM World operation, even files naming Commander Juan Almeida, the head of the Cuban Army, who was going to lead that coup for JFK. All these files, you know, right at the end. So then there was another year after the review board ended. Everybody went home. The agencies had an extra year to offer up whatever they felt like.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, right this very minute, the National Archives will not say how many pages of JFK files or how many hundreds of hours of tapes of people like Carlos Marcello talking about the JFK assassination remain unreleased. They won't even give the figure. Now, those files were all supposed to have been released in the 90s. Anything withheld for national security is supposed to be released in 2017, but we don't know. Are we talking a million pages, which is what NBC said, millions of pages, back in 98? And so it's just ridiculous.
Why are they stonewalling this?
two big reasons, and we're going to talk about one today in respect to the Secret Service. They're hiding embarrassing information. Now, you may wonder, why does what someone did 50 years ago impact agencies today? Well, here's why. In those days, you and I have this gray hair because we remember when people would get a job and keep it for 30 years.
Right.
I mean, my father, I think he...
My dad, too, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they did. So
40
so,
years.
Yeah, so people who were coming up, who were active in the 60s, I mean, they weren't retiring in many cases until the, you know, till the late 80s, even the early 90s, and their proteges who came up under them, who owe them their loyalty, they're still in position.
You're talking about in institutions like the CIA, the NSA, the Secret Service.
Right, because presidents come and go. The directors of those agencies, they come and go. But it's your, you know, number three, four, five, six guys in those organizations who are there for the career.
Right.
And plus, the other problem is, once you start covering things up, how can you ever reveal it? Secret Service, for instance, in coordination with the CIA and the FBI and Naval Intelligence, withheld that attempt to kill JFK in Tampa, Florida, 4 days before Dallas.
Right. We dug that out.
We looked through thousands of pages of newspaper microfilm.
I remember it well.
You know, and we found one little article that slipped out the day after JFK was killed. And then the very next day, like, nobody knew anything.
Right.
But luckily, when I called the Tampa chief of police in the mid-90s, he's like, hey, I've been waiting on this call for 30 years. I thought the Warren Commission, and we'll talk about them in a minute, too, they couldn't ask the chief of police in Tampa about the Tampa attempt because the Secret Service didn't tell them there had been one 4 days before Dallas. Think how different everything would have been if the general public had known. Now, why was it kept secret at the time? The Kennedys wanted it kept secret, and they had been making plans, and this is in the book, and you and I have talked about this before. For 2 months before JFK's murder, Bobby Kennedy had a secret subcommittee of the National Security Council. And there's actual documentation. You can see some of it in the book, and I'm going to try to post more online soon. Making plans for what to do if an American official was assassinated.
Right. This was their Cuba contingency plan. This was the what if, we keep trying to kill Castro. What if he gets sufficiently PO'd that he takes out our ambassador to Guatemala or something?
And being a perfect example. And as a close aide to one of the Kennedys explained to me, who actually got to read all of the hundreds of pages of the Cuba contingency plans, I can tell you there were at least five agencies involved. They were supposed to make 10 copies of each draft. There were a dozen drafts. You know, one agency released two drafts and one piece of paper. And all the other agencies just hid that this planning ever existed. But you're right.
And this was the plan, by the way, that was invoked when Kennedy was killed, where they nationalized his body, basically mutilated it and lied to the Warren Commission.
Well, what you have to think of is, again, a close Kennedy aide explained this to me. He said, how would it look? Okay, so we're getting ready to overthrow Fidel Castro. Not an assassination attempt the way they saw it. Not involving the mafia, as the Kennedys,
Right.
This
is the real deal, using the number three guy in Cuba,
right,
the head of the army.
The head of the Cuban army, the founder of the Cuban army,
right.
Much more powerful
Juan
than
Che
Guevara. Right. And so, who by the way, only died, I believe, in 2011, I think it was,
yeah,
or 2009.
Very,
I mean, yeah, very recently. So, again, we get to that, why so much secrecy for so long.
Right. Lamar, we're hitting a break here. We'll come back.
Sure.
Okay? Lamar Waldron is with us. His new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. And it's great to have Lamar back in the studio. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the trade paperback for The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. What is it, available online now? Should be soon. Yeah. So you were talking about how we were talking about the Cuba contingency plan.
Right. In other words,
this is in the context of the larger context of these agencies trying to cover up embarrassing.
Right. In other words, so the three points to remember are, we were getting ready, the U.S., super, super top secret program, to overthrow Fidel Castro using the number three man in Cuba to head the Cuban army, who would not claim credit from later released CIA files. It does appear the Apache, or fall guy, which is what Harry Williams called the person, would take the blame and CIA
or
files.
Or the credit.
show, right, the credit, right. And would and he would probably, according to CIA files, be a Russian or a Russian sympathizer.
Right.
So it would look like the Russians had killed.
It would look like Khrushchev had taken out.
Right.
Castro.
The Russians were trying to just take over Cuba,
right.
And had killed Fidel. Almeida could go on television and say, the dastardly Russians have killed our beloved Fidel. That would neutralize the more than 10,000 Russians still in Cuba. So that was going to happen December 1st. You know, we have the documentation, 1963, 10 days after Dallas. In case Castro found out, tried to retaliate by assassinating U.S. official, these Cuba contingency plans were made for what to do if it looked like the ambassador to Guatemala, to use your example, had been assassinated.
By Castro.
Well,
you know, it looked like it was by Castro.
Well, or what if he's even just shot and you don't know if it's by Castro? So the plan, as it was described to me, and I actually talked to someone who actually worked on the plan, as well as somebody who saw all the drafts, was you don't want to start World War III only to find out he had been shot by, you know, his mistress's jealous lover. Not that the ambassador to Guatemala in 63 had a mistress. I don't know. I'm just using that as a hypothetical.
No,
or it could have been just a common street robbery,
mm-hmm.
You know. So the Cuban contingency planning that was done, and the plans weren't finished, but the planning was to buy time for the president to make a reasoned decision, which is why you had to have a military autopsy at a U.S. military base, because you wouldn't want some Guatemalan hospital trying to autopsy this ambassador with all the leaks.
Right.
We just saw with the new Iraqi prime minister what can happen when a foreign leader right. says the wrong thing. So that's why you have to get it to a U.S. military facility like Bethesda.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the conference this week is in Bethesda.
Right.
So.
Oh, interesting. Which is where where Jack's body was taken.
Right, right. And you would have to have federal.
Are you going to do it in the autopsy room?
No. We're not actually on the base. We're at a hotel there. But again, that's why you would have. And as it turned out, it was Bobby Kennedy that was controlling the autopsy, not shadowy generals. Bobby Kennedy. And Admiral Berkeley, JFK's personal physician, they were in charge. There's plenty of documentation of that. Bobby wound up with all the sensitive evidence that was never fully analyzed, like JFK's brain, that apparently was reburied with JFK when he was permanently interred, I think, around 1967. Plus, that helped ensure that District Attorney Jim Garrison could not subpoena kind of evidence. So all that was going on. So there was a lot of secrecy, and a lot of secrecy was designed to prevent World War III. That was the bottom line. Prevent World War III. This is a year after that tense nuclear standoff of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Unfortunately, tragically, JFK killed the mafia who had been barred from the coup plan, barred from reopening their casinos if he was successful, managed to infiltrate it, and kill JFK instead. But these agents had used all that secrecy for 50 years to hide their own mistakes back in 1963 that have continued to this day.
20 minutes past the hour. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Lamar Waldron in the studio with me, the author of The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. Shortly be available in paperback, in trade paperback. And the in town for a conference of JFK assassination researchers. And
we should add journalists and historians. People don't realize how many tenured historians are, fully behind a conspiracy. I mean, there's Dr. David Kaiser.
Well, Congress was fully behind a conspiracy.
People forget that. I mean, there was a big editorial, I believe, in the New York Times recently, and I need to go back and read it in depth, but when I skimmed it, it was making it sound like, it's kind of new to believe in a conspiracy, but there were at least five investigations into the assassination that followed the Warren Commission. And the most recent congressional investigation did conclude in 1979 that JFK was definitely, they used the term because they're Congress, likely killed by a conspiracy, and that Carlos Marcello, godfather of Louisiana and Texas, and Santo Trafficante, the godfather of Tampa and the father of the French Connection heroin network, had the, quote, motive, means, and opportunity to have killed JFK. They couldn't, and they did refer it for prosecution to the Justice Department and the FBI, but they couldn't be more definitive, and they didn't know about the role of Johnny Roselli, the associate of Marcello and Trafficante, because Trafficante had him killed shortly before the House Select Committee was formed.
And dismembered and stuffed into a 56-gallon
So much
barrel.
Was withheld from them by, like, the Tampa attempt, like these Cuba contingency plans, an attempt to kill JFK in Chicago 3 weeks before Dallas, the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was under tight surveillance by naval intelligence the entire time he was back in the United States after his so-called defection to the Soviet Union. So much was withheld. And the Secret Service, because they've been in the news recently, you know, they're just the worst example. There were other things that the Warren Commission never fully found out about. People have heard so we recently had the intruder who got in.
Right, and you've got right-wingers all over America because the president is a Democrat saying, oh, my God, the Secret Service has fallen apart. It must be because of the president.
Right. But, you know, these things have been going on for ages. You may remember there have been three horrible drinking incidents, you know, one in the Netherlands. And this is President Obama. Easy to get them confused. Security detail,
right.
You know, drinking incidents in the Netherlands, the drinking and the prostitution thing in Colombia, and then down in Miami. And then, you know, there's been this huge ongoing lawsuit with racism and a noose and just horrible problems. Well, go back to 1963. They had horrible problems with racism. Back then,
Bolton on this program, a former Secret Service agent, first black Secret Service agent to serve in the presidential detail.
Exactly right.
Laid all his stuff out.
Right. He had to leave the presidential detail because his superiors wouldn't act on the racism.
Yeah.
And then he also noticed incredibly heavy drinking, you know, within hours of needing to protect the president. What was originally hidden from the Warren Commission, and then they found out a little, was that 10 Secret Service agents were out drinking until between 3 and 5 a.m. the morning, like literally, you know, hours, 7 hours before the bullets flew, in a sleazy club in Fort Worth owned by a buddy of Jack Ruby's. And reportedly, some of the agents were drinking, you know, pure Everclear alcohol. That's what the bar owner said. It's actually a coffee shop, so they had to secretly serve the liquor. And that was originally hidden from the Warren Commission. They eventually found out a little about it. So we simply see these problems today, even the presidential protection problems. You know, I mean, the thing with the recent thing is nothing compared to what happened in Chicago, where they were shadowing four men, the Secret Service was. Well, they'd heard four men were going to try to kill JFK. They were shadowing two of them. One of the agents blew the surveillance. They got away. The only person who wound up getting arrested in Chicago was an ex-military guy who apparently was the fall guy who worked in a warehouse overlooking the motorcade route, had arms and ammo and stuff in his car. But they didn't even charge him with that because they were supposed to keep this attempt secret. So they charged him with having, I think it was some sort of a bladed weapon in his front seat, which does, again, ring bells with that recent attempt at the White House, because that guy had a knife. And then when they searched his car, he had, I believe, 800 rounds of ammunition.
Right.
So those
the knife was apparently a pocket knife.
Right. It was, I think,
that he always carried with him.
Yeah. The ammo is a little more troubling.
Yeah.
But again, he was a troubled ex-serviceman. And I'm sure, he had PTSD. So I'm not putting anything on him at all. But again, if we go back to Chicago, the real assassins got away because the Secret Service blew the surveillance. And only the guy who was apparently intended to be the Chicago Patsy.
The Chicago Oswald.
Right, the Chicago Oswald. And by the way, there was a Tampa Oswald,
right.
A guy, a Cuban exile. And the guy in Chicago had a dozen parallels to Oswald. The guy in Tampa had two dozen parallels.
For example,
Oswald.
Parallels.
Well, the one in Tampa, for instance, he hung out with the Fair Play for Cuba committee. Some of his friends thought he was pro-Castro. Others thought he was anti-Castro. He actually got into what some people think was a staged fist fight. He moved away from his wife at the same time Oswald moved away from his wife. He went to the Tampa Oswald, Gilberto Policarpo Lopez, actually then went to Dallas after Trafficante called off the Tampa attempt because authorities had found out about it. So, and they're about the same age. They're even about the same physical description. In fact, the description for the assailant that was being sought in Tampa while JFK was going ahead with his motorcade, because he had to, because he was going to give a speech that night in Miami with a few lines written specifically to reassure Commander Almeida that, yes, in 2 weeks you should go ahead with that coup. So JFK couldn't, even though this was the second threat, you know, in 2.5 weeks, he couldn't call it off. He had to go through with it. The description issued in Tampa for the unknown assailant who was going to shoot JFK from a tall building matches Oswald. It matches Gilberto Lopez very well, but it matches Oswald better than the first description put out in Dallas. So, so again, there weren't three different plans. Now, there was one plan.
To kill President Kennedy in three different cities over a 2 or 3 week period.
Right, and three different patsies who have remarkable similarities between them. So if Oswald had been hit by a truck the day before,
then they would have slewed Lopez.
He was already in.
So the plan was triply redundant, and then doubly redundant within the triple redundancy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Amar Waldron's new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, soon out in trade paperback. You can check it out at your favorite source. We'll be back with Lamar and your calls for Lamar. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And here in the studio with me today, Lamar Waldron, author of The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, and his new book on the Oswald assassination.
Right. That's actually great wording to use, because Lee Harvey Oswald was assassinated by somebody working for Carlos Marcello and Santo Trafficante, an actual personal associate of them, just as JFK was.
And arguably Jack Ruby was assassinated, too, by Texas refusing to let him out of the Texas jails. He was begging. He was to J. Edgar Hoover. He was saying, I'll tell you stuff if you get me out of this state.
Right. And then he has a physical, and, he's clear to go. His conviction, he's granted a new trial because, it was pretty biased to try him in Dallas, where he fronted a sleazy strip club for Marcello's organization.
Right.
And then within a week or so of that court decision saying, you got to move him from his cell reportedly overlooking Dealey Plaza. I haven't confirmed that, but it's been reported his cell overlooked Dealey Plaza. What a reminder to keep your mouth shut. And within a week of that, having a perfect physical, he comes down with cancer and dies. Before he can be moved to, I think it was Wichita Falls, for his new trial.
Amazing, amazing. We've got a bunch of questions from people here. One point. I just went over and I was the second signature in the petition. Lamar's was the first. If you go to the hidden history of the JFK assassination.com, yes, it has the thes and the ofs and the whole, the hidden history of the JFK assassination. And there's four S's in assassination. A-double-S. A-double-S.
You're better spelling.
INATION. Oh, I'm looking at the back of the book. If you go to that website, you can sign this petition to release these files and also to pardon Abraham Bolden, who has been on this program and you and I have both written about.
Who was framed by the mafia when he came to Washington to tell the Warren Commission staff about the Chicago attempt, about the Tampa,
right, and then he ended
about
up
the
in
excessive
jail.
Drinking. And these mob operatives framed him, and his main accuser later admitted under oath, he committed perjury.
Yeah.
And Bolden's judge told the jury Bolden was guilty.
Amazing stuff.
So if you want to get all the files released while you're still alive, because Jay says they might not release them in 2017, and pardon Bolden, go to the hidden history of the JFK assassination.com. That'll have a link to this White House petition. Right now we have two signatures, mine and Tom's. We need to get a total of 100,000.
Right, to get the White House to respond.
Official White House response. And then two more things, too, Tom. I'm going to be working with your people about getting a tweet out about that.
Yeah, we'll tweet it out as soon as we get off the air.
And if people, because we're just who we are. Okay, we don't have the big publicity machines that the right wing has. But if people will retweet your tweet and ask their friends to do it, ask their friends to sign that petition, maybe we can get this going. There's also on the hidden history of the JFK assassination.com, I just kind of restarted my Facebook page. Mm-hmm. So the same thing there. Go there. Share that. It's got information about Bolden, about the files. And, social media is probably the only way we're going to have any chance to really get the White House's attention. And so, because the White House should just order, these agencies to comply with that 1992
right.
law.
All it would take is an executive order. Channing in Indianapolis, Indiana. You have a question for Lamar. Channing?
Yeah.
Hey, hello? You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I want to believe in this in the conspiracy theory. I do. I've read, you know, watched Oliver Stone stuff and seen my PBS Frontline about it. The thing that I can't understand, though, is if there's a conspiracy, they would have had to have arranged Oswald's employment at the school book depository. And I don't see how that could have been done, given the facts. Could you maybe go into that a little bit?
Well, sure, because if you look at the facts real closely, not it's just Oswald in isolation, but Oswald in terms of these other two patsies in Chicago and Tampa. At the same time, Oswald, you know, he made that very mysterious to many people trip to Mexico City, which I fully explain in the book. Then he comes back to Dallas. He does not move in with his wife and his child. He goes to a rooming house. Boy, first he stays at a YMCA. He starts looking for these jobs. Well, at the very minute he's checking into a YMCA in Dallas, in Chicago, that the ex-Marine in Chicago Valley is also checking into a YMCA, also looking for jobs. And guess what? Both Oswald and Valley both wind up with jobs at warehouses overlooking, I mean, really, really well overlooking JFK's motorcade route in places where the motorcade would have to slow down a great deal. In other words, the motorcade, both in Valley's case and in Oswald's case, it's not like they're going 40 miles an hour. They're having to almost come to a complete stop. So when you look at it in that context, and I do have a lot of other information in the book that explains Oswald, you know, the job and his activity.
So who helped Oswald get this job in this place where he could be accused of assassinating the president?
Basically, there's six different witnesses that saw Oswald with, and most of them say he was working for, a guy in New Orleans by the name of Guy Bannister, the ex-FBI chief of Chicago, who was a heavy drinker, white supremacist, you know, ultra anti-communist kind of guy. He also and Oswald was working for Bannister in the summer of 63. Bannister also did a lot of work for naval intelligence and some for the CIA as well. So Oswald was never, I hate to say it, a genuine member of the far left. Ask yourself this. How many teenage communists, and that's what the Warren Commission said Oswald was, a teenage communist from the time he was a teenager. How many teenage communists not only joined the Civil Air Patrol, not only joined the United States Marines in the McCarthy 50s, but try to join the United States Marines a year before they're old enough, and then when he's in the Marines, he goes around spouting a love. And this is the McCarthy 50s, you know, when people are getting blacklisted, committing suicide, being sent to prison, being kept political prisoners. Oswald's going around the Marine base, you know, not a bunch of softies there, especially these Marine drill sergeants, spouting a love of Russia and Russian so much, supposedly teaching himself to speak Russian, a very difficult language, so much that his fellow Marine buddies call him Oswaldskovich. Guess how many times Oswald was ever attacked by his fellow Marines for that, was written up, was disciplined? Zero. So
well,
in other words, Oswald...
Well, and he ended up in Japan at Natsuki Air Force Base.
The secret U-2 base in Japan.
Where he was learning Russian, and from there he defects to the Soviet Union.
Well, he actually learned Russian, I think it was... Monterey Language Institute in California. But yeah, he was actually doing intelligence work in Tokyo. Oswald didn't, you know, finish high school, 120 IQ, but learning disabilities. You know, he's going to this bar, and we all kind of generally know what Japanese bars are like, and you have these hostesses. It costs a lot of money. The queen bee, the top, most beautiful, most expensive hostess at this one bar, does she hang out with the officers there? You know, the enlisted men who have money? No, she hangs out with Oswald. Again, we know from his fellow Marines, he was already working for naval intelligence at that time.
And
so,
everybody knew it. And they realized that his I Love Russia was a front.
Right, it was a front. That's why his fellow Marines didn't beat him up. One of his own fellow Marines, you and I tried to track down this guy, thought Oswald was so strange that before the assassination, this guy, Cary Thornley, wrote a book about Oswald because this guy was so bizarre.
Yeah.
So basically, Oswald
Guy
was
Bannister
working,
helps on Oswald
well,
get the
well, Guy Bannister's working
job.
For U.S. intelligence, naval
right.
intelligence, CIA, and
now they don't want Oswald on the assassination route. It's the mafia who wants him on the assassination
right.
route.
Right. there, Oswald thinks he's going to get another assignment. You know, he was one of six young men around the same age that went to Russia around the same time on these funny defections. Five came back around the same time with Russian wives. We wanted to see the United States government, how the KGB would then try to keep contact with Oswald or his wife.
Right. So he was bait.
So he was under tight naval surveillance. Handling that tight surveillance was, in New Orleans, was Guy Bannister and Guy Bannister's associate, the former Eastern Airlines pilot by the name of David Ferry, also rabid anti-communist, also a former CIA asset.
And David Ferry was the pilot for Carlos Marcello.
And Guy Bannister was the private detective for Carlos Marcello. So U.S. intelligence in Washington, they're looking at this distinguished guy, Guy Bannister, former FBI chief of Chicago, you know, does good work for the CIA and FBI, as...
Put him in charge of handling Oswald.
As handling Oswald.
And he's actually working for Marcello, who is trying to position Oswald to take the fall for a hit that Marcello is
right. So I'm totally certain Oswald was told to get a job in Dallas in some sort of a warehouse, and he was told the general area to do this in. But again, it's, you know, he's one of several people doing these same things at the same time.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's amazing. We have less than a minute before we're going to hit a break, right? Because we've got a bunch of calls, a bunch of questions. One of these is a question about the role of Robert Kennedy going after the mob.
Oh, very important. Robert, basically, John and Robert Kennedy led the biggest war against organized crime America had ever seen to that point and really has ever seen. I mean, it was enormous because the mob had the run of not just the United States, but also Cuba in the 50s under Vice President Nixon, who was in bed with the mafia from his very first race for Congress when Mickey Cohen, the Los Angeles mobster, you know, gave money. I mean, so Nixon was in the mafia's pocket.
He was the vice president, and J. Edgar Hoover was being blackmailed by the mafia.
It was literally up to Senator John F. Kennedy to use these labor hearings to go after Jimmy Hoffa and his mafia allies because the government really wasn't doing it.
But the Kefauver hearing?
No, that was earlier. This was the McClellan. But it was JFK and Bobby's show all the way.
Amazing. Lamar Waldron with us. His new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. The website, www.thehiddenhistoryofthejfkassassination.com. Check it out. Sign the petition.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, soon out, like a matter of weeks here in trade paperback. You can pre-order it or order it at your favorite outlet. And welcome back. James in Spokane, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You have a question for Lamar?
Excuse me. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to ask if you think there's any relevancy to inadvertently or advertently, the George Hickey, the Secret Service agent, in the follow-up vehicle might have let loose a round from his AR-15 rifle and hit Kennedy in the head.
Glad you asked that question. You know, there are two theories out there. One was that theory, that George Hickey, his gun went off. That has been looked into so much, there is absolutely zero credibility to it. You know, there were plenty of witnesses there. Yeah, there was a lot of film going on, and like I say, it just didn't happen. And when the book was originally published,
which book?
There was actually a book that the Secret Service agent accidentally shot JFK.
Right.
I believe there was some sort of a carefully worded apology from the publisher.
Huh.
But then people die, and theories get refloated. You and I actually heard the theory way back that the Secret Service driver turned around and shot JFK.
Right.
And sure enough.
I remember a guy really aggressively trying to convince me of this.
Right, Bill Cooper.
Yeah.
And sure enough, the power of suggestion, when he would show a really bad copy of a copy of a copy of the Zapruder film, and you're told that, you know, you're kind of looking and you can't really tell. Luckily, the Zapruder film, which, by the way, guys, is authentic. I mean, that's been looked into very, very, very closely. Because I think it shows conspiracy, so they wouldn't fake it. No, the Secret Service driver does not do it. We should add, for the Secret Service driver, he was not one of the people out drinking until 3 to 5 a.m.
That particular guy.
And he slowed down because, as one of the guys in the follow-up car told you, one of JFK's closest aides, they thought they were riding into an ambush because the first shot came from the front, came from the grassy knoll. So anybody, especially a trained Secret Service driver, is going to hit the brakes when they hear a shot from the front.
Right, yeah. And that was Dave Powers who told me that. Al in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, Al. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You have a question for Lamar?
Mostly comments. As I recall, originally in the 50s, the CIA started the Manchurian Candidate program, and they tested thousands of Marines from Korea and Japan. And those five or six Marines that went into Russia was the original graduates from the program. That's why the naval intelligence watched them so closely.
Anything to this, Lamar?
Unfortunately not. Manchurian Candidate was a good movie. The CIA did a lot of experiments. Don't get me wrong. A lot of experiments with mind control.
Right.
But and was odd that Oswald ever take LSD. He went into, I believe it was in New York, the New Orleans District Attorney's office, and I believe asked if LSD was legal or illegal, because in 63 it was still legal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't rule out that he in a very low level way, like some other Marines might have, gotten high, been dosed at some time or whatever, but that really tight mind control where people are doing things they don't want to do, you know, the CIA success rate there is extremely, extremely low, and Oswald has rational, well-documented reasons for every single thing he did.
Yeah, I have a friend who, thank you, Al, for the call, a friend who went to MIT back in the 60s and was given acid by the government and, without being told, ended up being compensated for it. I mean, the stuff is out.
There was a whole village in France where I believe they dosed the village.
Wow.
And that was covered up here. So the CIA does try that, but that doesn't...
But not successfully. We'll be back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our board op, Troy Miller, writer-researchers Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks at all the various companies that carried this program to you, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, others around the country, the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and all the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors and underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. In the studio with us is Lamar Waldron, his new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, shortly out in trade paperback. Any day now, any week now, you can pre-order it from pretty much wherever you get your books from.
And I should say this, the hardback has been discounted on Amazon, but of course you also want to patronize your local bookstores. This is one of the few books where I did, the only book, where I did not extensively revise from the hardback to the trade paperback. So in our previous books, Ultimate Sacrifice, Legacy of Secrecy, you always want to get those trade paperbacks because there was just huge stuff. 100 pages or more, just totally
redone. They were not in the original hardcovers.
Yeah. Right. Even the Watergate book, Hidden History of Watergate, there were five critical new pages at the start. This book, the hardback, the trade paperback, whatever you can get the best deal on.
Go for it. There you go. And the website is thehiddenhistoryofthejfkassassination.com, where you can sign the petition to pardon Abraham Bolden and release these documents. Sheila in Tempe, Arizona, you're on the air with Lamar Waldron.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. But I have to tell you that I am a firm believer of Lee Harvey Oswald having acted alone. I have since the day the assassination. I was 20 when it happened, and also Clint Hill feels that way. I attended a book signing just a few months ago. He was, as everybody knows, the agent, the Secret Service agent for Jackie Kennedy. At that time, I've also read Vincent Bugliosi's book, which I'm sure you have also and disagree with. It just seems to me there are so many. This is the last comment. There are conspiracies all over the place. I don't doubt there could have been a conspiracy in Chicago and all this. Any president is going to get it. I'm sure Obama has. There's probably dozens of potential conspiracies right now to assassinate him. But anyway, I would just like your comment about what I had to say. And again, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to address that if you could, Tom.
Go for it.
Sure. Well, I don't... I haven't read Clint Hill's book because the Secret Service agent books are notoriously, you know, light on substantial stuff.
Right, and they're biopic.
Right, and I don't believe he recounts, you know, going to the Cellar Door Club in Fort Worth with 10 of his agents. Now, he had drinks there. What this club did, because it didn't have a liquor license, you could buy, say, orange Kool-Aid flavored with rum flavoring.
Mm.
Because the Dallas cops originally, you know, somebody would get like orange juice with vodka. Well, the Dallas cops originally would go in and stick their fingers in, and if they taste the vodka, they'd arrest, you know, the owner. Mm. Well, what he started doing, well, he would have vodka flavoring. So the Dallas cops, even if they stuck your finger in the drink. So, you know, so I'm willing to grant that Clint Hill, who did act as he should have that day, he was just probably drinking flavored Kool-Aid, but he was there and he did drink something there. Well, let's say it was flavored Kool-Aid, but some of those agents, you know, were probably drinking more than that. But again, I do want to stress the Secret Service had nothing to do with killing JFK.
Right.
Jack Ruby did apparently send over some strippers, you know, but the fact that the Secret Service agents were out drinking and partying with these scantily clad waitresses, they were taken there by Bob Schieffer, the CBS news anchor who worked for a Dallas media outlet. Then, you know, they wore only underwear and bikinis. The reason they were out partying that late was because there was no threat as there had been in Chicago and Tampa.
Right. So in Chicago and Tampa, the Secret Service knew that there was an active threat against the president to assassinate him. They thought by the time they got to Dallas, it was over.
It was over.
And now we can have a party.
Now we bring on
the strippers.
Now we can relax. And again, for your listener, I would just, you know, if she can answer those questions, she can find another teenage communist teenager in the 50s, McCarthy 50s, who joined the United States Marines and who spouted that love of Russia and all things Russian so much and never got disciplined for it. Somebody besides Oswald.
Well, also, at the time of the shooting, Oswald was not on the sixth floor of the school book depository. I mean, isn't that fairly well established?
Well, again, I have to say this. You know, the mafia doesn't leave anything to chance. They laid out a pretty good, you know, they framed him very well. But there are many problems. You and I have been in a couple of documentaries on Discovery Channel that NBC News produced. One of those guys were like, well, we're going to show Oswald taking the rifle in the book depository that morning wrapped his curtain rod.
Right.
I'm like, no, can't do that. The one guy that saw Oswald enter that building that morning said there was nothing in his hands.
Right.
So, in other words, he did take a package with him to work. Also, the guy who gave him a lift, who's going to be at the conference, said Oswald held the package cupped under his
armpit
and cupped in his hand in a way that a dismantled Mannlicher Carcano cannot be held that way. It's too long. So whatever Oswald took, it may not have been the curtain rods that was his cover story, but it wasn't a Mannlicher Carcano, and nobody saw him take anything into that book depository. And so there are dozens of those things. There's plenty of evidence Oswald was down, I believe it was the second
floor. Yeah, it was the second floor where the lunch counter was.
Or and there was a Coke machine there. In fact, you know, the first cop to run in there saw Oswald.
Ran into Oswald.
All right, saw him by the Coke machine. So, you know, and then people said, well, he came down the stairs really quick. No, there were people who were on those stairs who did not see Oswald. So, again, I grant there's a good circumstantial case against Oswald, but it all falls apart.
And if you have any doubts, pick up The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination by Lamar Waldron. And it's all there. There's also a fair amount of the website, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. And you can sign the petition. Lamar, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for being with us today, all this week. We'll be back next week. And don't forget, in the meantime, democracy is not a spectator sport. It doesn't accidentally happen. It requires you. Tag your in. Get over there and sign that petition to get Abraham Bolden's address.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.